Sunrose Yoga. Reveal and remember your sacred nature through the practice of yoga. The Sunrose Yoga Podcast is a collection of audio recordings, videos, and writings about the practices of yoga. The podcast's mission is to share the teachings of yoga in an accessible way and to foster meaningful discussion about the practices. To learn more or to experience past teachings, please visit sunroseyoga.com. The Sunrose Yoga Podcast is made possible by the generous donations of students and supporters. If you find this podcast useful or beneficial, please consider making a secure online donation by clicking the donate button at sunroseyoga.com. And thanks. Hello, my beloveds, and welcome to episode 109 of the Sunrose Yoga Podcast. I'm Kelly. Thank you so much for being here with me today and always as we move along this path of practice and life together. Today's episode is an interview, a spacious conversation that I had with yogini, dancer, artist, human, Renee Sills. One of the things that I really enjoyed about this interview was that we got to talk about what the point of this practice is, and I really enjoyed hearing what Renee had to say about that. And I'd love for you to share your experience of yoga. What is the point of all of this, my beautiful darlings? And you can connect with your answer or your questions in a number of ways. You can always write to me at sunroseyoga@gmail.com. You can connect on our Facebook page and, you know, Twitter, all of the, you know, usual suspects with respect to social media. And you can also leave me a voicemail. I don't know if you guys know this, but I do have this Google Voice number. I've had it for many years, but I have not really used it. It's really just voicemail. And if you'd like to leave your answer to this question, what is the point of this practice of yoga? You can do that at area code 503-583-2599. Thank you all so much for being here. So on to my interview with Renee. Let me tell you a little bit about Renee. She is a yoga teacher. She is a certified somatic movement educator, and a registered yoga therapist with the International Association of Yoga Therapists. Renee has completed over 1,000 hours of certification and training with her principal teachers, including Richard Freeman, Bonnie Bainbridge-Cohen, and Amy Matthews. Renee is a graduate of the Somatic Movement Educator Program and the Embodied Developmental Movement and Yoga Program at the School for Body-Mind Centering. She's also completed 7 years of apprenticeship in dance therapy and leadership with Melissa Michaels, and she's on faculty for Surfing the Creative, a movement-based Rites of Passage Summer Program and Youth Leadership Camp. Renee continues to study with her teachers, including body-mind centering, yoga and anatomy with Amy Matthews, whom she assists in the Embodied Anatomy and Yoga Program in Portland, and body-mind centering with Bonnie Bainbridge-Cohen, and yoga with Todd Jackson of the Portland Yoga Arts. To learn more about Renee, visit her website, reneesills.com. Let's talk a little bit about, like, how you came to the practice. Like, how did you come to yoga?
I I mean, I guess when I think about the practice of yoga, there's like different, well, I guess it's just there are different assumptions that someone could make about what the that practice is. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I feel like in a certain way I grew up with it.
Mm-hmm.
That my both of my parents were pretty invested in inquiry of different types. My dad is and was really political and active, and taught me to think critically from a really young age. And my mom was always really drawn to like alternative healing and kind of like new age, like different approaches to spirituality and astrology. And it was through her that I became really invested in like body-centered therapies. She was a somatic therapist, and she introduced me to my first teacher, who was and is a dance teacher. But I would say that what she does is yoga. You know, she teaches a process of attention and realization through the body.
Mm-hmm.
And develops a certain set of tools for recognizing when something comes in that's not you, specifically emotions,
mm-hmm.
And how to work with the emotional terrain through your body. So I worked with her starting when I was 11, and then pretty intensively until I was 18 was her student. And then I took a couple years off, and in college studied art and was reading a lot of theory and philosophy, and got interested in yoga and Eastern mysticism. So I started reading books and started practicing at home, like
mm-hmm.
probably for 2 years, had a home practice just from looking at pictures and reading about poses.
Do you remember any of the books that were your like first teachers?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Light on Yoga.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's where I got like a lot of the poses from. Mm-hmm. And then I have Patricia Walden's book, A Woman's Book of Yoga and Health.
Mm-hmm.
And I use that one a lot. And there's one other one that I'm having trouble remembering what it is right now. But it doesn't matter. You know, and my first attempts at asana were kind of to, I had a lot of digestive problems and was like, had a lot of stress and depression. So it was pretty therapeutic, like what I was looking for.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what I got, like if I got anything from those practices, it was less about the postures that I was doing and more that I developed like a real love of taking like 1 or 2 hours alone in my room and breathing and doing things that I became kind of absorbed in.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple years later, I had a friend who was going to this like hot yoga, it wasn't like a power studio, just like a hot, not Bikram, not mm-hmm. it, but yeah, just this hot yoga studio in Montreal. So, and they had like a, forget what the intro deal was, it was like your first month for $20 or something like that. So I went and really liked it and just started going like every day, like sometimes like 2 or 3 times a day I'd go to those classes. And during that time, my home practice stopped, but I was just like obsessed with these classes. And probably for about, I don't know, like maybe a year, somewhere in like a year of going there, and they brought in a guest teacher, a man from Canada. Or I was in Montreal, but so he was from Saskatoon. And I'd say like he's like my first like real inspiring yoga teacher, whereas like it was something just like about the way that he was teaching and what he was excited about that really resonated with me. And we became friends, and then I got reinvigorated to study philosophy from talking to him. Because I had, you know, I kind of like put it to the side and was like doing school and making art and really enjoying this yoga thing. And I had this whole different life. Like I was a bartender and I was like up late at night and smoking cigarettes and was like, you know, a total partier. And then I was doing hot yoga, and it was like I'd go and like sweat out all these toxins, but then I'd go right back into my, like I'd leave the yoga studio and have a cigarette. Like that was totally like what I was doing. And yeah, so he and I became friends, and then I think it was at that time that I really started to think more about my lifestyle and like of the practice of yoga being something that I had agency in and that I could incorporate into other parts of my life. And I was, it's funny, I was just thinking this morning about like how we have mental observations that it, like they can be really obvious ones about ourselves, but it's like until we have them, we're one way, and then it's like as soon as we have them, things change.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it was around that time in my life that I had this observation that I said no to a lot of things, and that I had a lot of insecurity and like would just like greet things with suspicion and like not try new things, and I would say no. And that, and I like realized that, and I was like, oh, I need to start saying yes to more things and like start to try things that are, you know, different than what I already do. So I just started like, I don't know, going back to dance classes. I've been really scared to take dance classes since I left the dance community because I just felt like I wasn't good at it. Mm-hmm. And started like trying to do more outdoors types of things, which was another thing where I, you know, just felt like I didn't have the skill or something. So my life really started to change around that time and continued to in that way. And then that studio, the hot yoga studio, probably about 2 years after I had been practicing there really regularly, they had this class that their recent graduates of their teacher training would teach that was a donation-based class. And this 1 month, they didn't have any graduates, and I was kind of friends with the owner, and she told me that they were going to cancel the classes, and I told her she couldn't cancel them because they were a pretty expensive studio. Mm-hmm. It's like, you can't cancel them because they're the only semi-affordable offering you.
Was this in Montreal?
Yeah. Dina, the owner, suggested that I teach them, and I said yes. So I had never done a teacher training, but I felt equipped because I think the movement just like intuitively made a lot of sense to me. So I started teaching, and I taught there for I think about 3 years, and in that time went to Colorado and did my first 200-hour training with Richard Freeman.
Oh, in Boulder?
Yeah. Yeah, and he was one of my, you know, like, first loves as a yoga teacher. His Yoga Matrix CDs and mm-hmm. his philosophy just, like, made me so happy. And I really wanted to study with him for those reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, so I did a couple of his trainings, the 200, and then I think two of the 100. Mm-hmm. Advanced trainings with him.
And those are they, does he call them Ashtanga trainings, or are they just Richard Freeman yoga workshop?
I think that the 200-hour training, I'm pretty sure, is a Ashtanga yoga teacher's intensive, you know? He's mm-hmm. not an RYS, so right. He doesn't say it's a teacher training.
Right.
And it wasn't, you know, there was nothing in the training about this is how you teach in terms of like standing up in front of a classroom or I don't know, now that I teach in teacher trainings, I'm realizing, like, wow, that thing that I did with him was not a was in no way a basics training. Which is, you know, kind of funny, but also fine. And I lied on the application because he was asking for people that had a regular Ashtanga practice for 5 years and who could do the second series and all this stuff. And I just totally lied because I wanted to get in, and yeah. My main intention was to go for the philosophy, and I told him that. And I found out later that I was the last person to get in. And I don't know if this is true or not, but I heard a rumor that he uses astrology to decide, like, who comes into the training.
Oh.
And it felt like such an auspicious time for me to be there and so perfect for what I needed. And, like, part of me has always thought that he, like, the room was so packed. Like, there wasn't room for me. I mean, there was room for me. But it was, like, mat to mat and his tiny little studio in Boulder.
Mm-hmm.
So what year was that? If you remember.
What year was that? I think that was 2000 and... Let's see. Let me think about how old I am now. Hold on. So that would have been like 8 years ago.
So like 2006?
Yeah, around 2006.
I was in Colorado doing my first teacher training then.
Oh, really?
Too.
Where?
So the Shambhava school, they have two ashrams. One is outside of Boulder called the El Dorado Mountain Ashram, and the other one is Shoshone.
Oh yeah, I know both of those places.
Yeah, and I did the bulk of my training in Denver at their school called the Whole Yoga School.
Oh, that's so funny.
We were there together at this auspicious time.
We met at Alpacas.
I know. Oh my gosh, that's wild. Oh.
That's so funny.
Oh, so Richard Freeman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then, so, anyway, that's how I got into it.
Yeah. Something that occurred to me, so when you were talking about, you know, when you were practicing in college, being in your room and having your home practice, I was wondering, and you talked about, this time of, absorption, and I'm wondering, were you aware of that at the time, or was that later reflection? At the time, were you in it, saying, "Oh, this is I'm absorbed in"?
I don't know that I would have made the connection to absorption as an aspect of meditation at that time. Which is what I'm taking out of your question right now. I don't know if that was important.
Mm-hmm.
But for sure, I was pretty aware at the time that I was not bored. You know, I was really interested and wanted to be doing it and felt protective of that time. You know, I have this memory of this apartment I lived in and my roommate and friend coming in, and I was doing a shoulder stand. And it's so funny, part of my memory is that I was doing it completely wrong, but I didn't know then. You know, now when I remember it, I'm like, oh my God, why was I doing it like that? But anyway, but she came in and she was trying to talk to me, and I was like, oh, you need to go away. I'm doing my practice. Leave. And I didn't have friends that were into yoga, so it was really private, which I liked.
Mm-hmm.
It was my private thing. And you know, now my life is totally different. All my friends do yoga and everyone talks about their practice, and it's not as private as it was, you know, in that way when I was doing it and didn't, I think, had no larger context to place it in, so it felt very personal to me.
Mm-hmm. Mm. So then how did you get from Richard Freeman's yoga workshop in Boulder to Portland, Oregon, where now, and where you teach and teach teachers and have your life?
Yeah, so I did a number of trainings with Richard and have been teaching, yeah, for about, let's see, I moved here in 2009, so I guess at that point I'd been teaching for about 4 years when I moved here. And I, let's see, I moved here and I really wanted to study more. And I was considering doing more training with him or, you know, I was looking for more Ashtanga. But I really wanted a woman teacher. I was really clear that I needed a female teacher. I'd had a really bad injury in Ashtanga and wasn't really trusting that practice so much. I felt like it was a little like harsh. And so I knew I wanted a female teacher and I was looking for something that was gentler or felt, you know, more healing to me. And I knew about Iyengar yoga and had done some of it and knew about Kundalini and had done some, but like I don't think I was necessarily attracted to other schools. And then I don't remember how I found out about it, but somehow I found out that Bonnie Bainbridge Cohen was doing this program in Berkeley. There was a 2-year certificate program called Embodied Developmental Movement in Yoga. And it was one of two application programs that the School of Body Mind Centering offers in yoga. And when I was a teenager, one of my mentors in high school had been a BMC practitioner. So I'd been exposed to it and I knew a little bit about it and had heard this person, my mentor Annie, talk about Bonnie. Mm-hmm. But I'd never met her, like had never really done BMC or, you know, anything like that. And I read the description and I just like knew I wanted to do it. So I signed up and I moved here in May and my program started in September of that year. So for my first 2 years that I was here, I would fly down to Berkeley like every 6 to 8 weeks to go for a week long session or module of the program. And it really changed my life. Like, well, first what happened is I got really tired. And BMC, or body mind centering, is such a restorative practice. And one of the, like, the critical elements of it as a practice is yielding. And learning to feel ground and learning to feel support and letting yourself be in relationship to that support. And I think just that as a practice was so different than how I had been living. Like I mean, I would say that like my entire life has been a survival mode kind of thing. Like my early childhood was not peaceful and it was pretty stressful in a number of ways. My mom died when I was young. You know, I've had a tricky relationship with my parents and I think I was really in like a survival mode type of place and then had done like all my own damage to myself, you know, of like living pretty recklessly, even with the yoga, and had kind of treated yoga like that too, you know, was like really drawn to Ashtanga and to this style, and I love Ashtanga, but to an approach to my personal practice that was pretty aggressive. So, yeah, coming into a space where not only was I, like, allowed to lie on the floor and just move the way that I wanted to move, but I could also fall asleep if I needed to fall asleep, and it was encouraged that I did, and there was a lot of hands-on touch, and a lot, like, much more emphasis on the inner experience than on any type of outer form. And then, of course, like, all the work of developmental movement, which a lot of it is like remembering embryonic patterns and kind of like relearning them, you know, and it's unable, I'm unable to articulate that in words, like what the experience is, because it's a felt experience, but it's cellular memory that comes up, and you go through all kinds of like primordial muck that's in your head and body, and things get sorted out, and you know, like babies after they're born just need to sleep all the time. And I feel like that's what happened to me, is I got into a place of such extreme fatigue, and I think really felt like the amount of adrenal fatigue I'd put myself through. So it was a pretty intense 2 years. I gained 20 pounds. I was just constantly tired. I got really depressed and was in a number of like totally dissatisfying and like pretty dysfunctional relationships. I you know, just felt wretched for a lot of it, but then was also, I think in that time, like really unpacking a lot that I layered on myself.
And did you have a sense that that was happening? Like, you know, like you're in whatever, you're moving through whatever muck. Was there a sense of like, this needs to happen, or were you like fighting it?
Both. I mean, I think it's my general outlook that things need to happen when they're happening. So there's that. But you know, I don't know if, like, I think it takes a lot of training actually to get to the point where you stop resisting when things are uncomfortable. And I think that's like a lifelong practice. Like, I think even the most evolved of the evolved, like, still resist when discomfort arises. So
absolutely.
Yeah, like I totally resisted it. It sucked. But you know, there was also like a lot of grace in those couple of years for me. I had moved here and was able to live with my godmother, who's one of my closest family that's left. She was my mom's best friend and has known me since I was born. And you know, the first year I don't think I paid rent, and then the second year I paid a pretty low amount of rent. I found teaching jobs fairly easily and was really in a place where like I could do that. And so there was all that, like I didn't feel like I had to struggle to make the space to fall apart in the way that I was falling apart. I don't know if I thought about it at that time, but now looking back on it, it's like, well, it was a necessary falling apart, and I was in an environment that allowed it to happen.
And so what was your teaching like then, because you have this Ashtanga structure and the BMC yielding, how did that play out when you're teaching at a yoga studio?
Yeah, well, it really changed my teaching. I moved here and was a power vinyasa teacher, you know, and I'd been teaching this hot studio in Montreal, but I hadn't done their teacher training, so I couldn't teach their name brand classes. Mm-hmm. But the Montreal studio had a number of like power flow classes that I could teach. So I taught those, and I moved to Portland and was that type of teacher, and did all right, you know, because I think Portland softens teachers, and like if people move here from other places, and students want to be challenged, you know, and they like to move, and yeah, I think it's true. Like Kira Ryder came to visit here a few years ago, and she said Portland is the place vinyasa goes to die, which I just thought was so funny, because I think that happens. Like, I've known so many teachers that just get less interested in striving. Mm-hmm. There's something about the yin and the magnetic qualities of the Pacific Northwest, I think, and Portland in general, that just, it feels hard to maintain, like, a really aggressive practice. Mm-hmm. Although I know people do, but I don't really know who they are. I mean, I know some of them, maybe, but... But yeah, so my teaching really changed. I lost a lot of students. My classes got a lot smaller for a while, and that was all right. I started to have a lot more understanding of the roots of vinyasa, because A lot of, let's see, the early developmental patterns after birth, well, even in utero, those patterns are limb and spinal patterns, and the form of sun salutation mimics those patterns.
Mm.
And so I started working with my vinyasa practice to evoke or to include the developmental patterns, and that made a huge shift for me in my experience of it. And I started teaching BMC because I would do a module there and then I would come back and teach it immediately. I would like set up a workshop for myself to teach what I had just learned, for me to learn it more, you know?
Yeah.
So my community of students really started to change, and I think for the first time had an understanding that I could work therapeutically. And a lot of body mind centering works with repatterning. So that started to become an interest, and my interest really shifted towards therapeutics. So I started reading a lot more about therapeutics and working more in it. And, you know, and then at the whole, through those, that first 2 years, like my body felt like it was falling apart a lot, and I couldn't do an aggressive practice. So I really had to slow down and like learn how to practice differently, which was, you know, really uncomfortable at the time, but also necessary.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, and then towards the end of the 2 years, like, it was after it had ended, I moved out of my godmother's house. I had decided to go to North Carolina to continue the BMC training, outside of the yoga program, so to go and just do pure body mind centering and to certify as a somatic movement educator, which is their kind of first level of BMC practitioner. So I decided to do that, and what happened? I started teaching yin yoga a lot, and was really remembering my interest in meditation and was practicing again. And I went to Seattle to do a like weekend workshop with Sarah Powers and loved her. Mm-hmm. And she inspired me to sit and have a sitting practice for 24 minutes a day, which I had never done before. Like I would sit and have different kind of things that I would play with meditation, but wasn't really consistent and didn't have a, you know, time limit for myself. Mm-hmm. So it was the end of these 2 years, and I was so depressed, and that this was like the big theme of that part of my life. And I had just moved out, and I made this, I just had this like these two relationships that just sucked so bad. They like destroyed me, you know, that my any like shred of self-confidence I had after that, you know, was just hanging on by a thread. Like I really was not liking myself very much, and teaching was kind of the only thing that I felt even partially good at, and it was the only place where I would stop thinking about how depressed I was, you know, because I would get to class and I couldn't think about like these people or what was going on. Like I just had to be present with the class. So I was teaching a lot because it was kind of like the only thing I had right then. And then I decided to, you know, to be abstinent, but also just to not, to be abstinent in every way, like emotionally and in terms of attention. And to really like go inwards for 9 months and to have this sitting practice for 24 minutes a day. And it was great. I feel like I went into like the belly of the beast and had some really transformative experiences where I had to like come face to face with my own self-hatred a lot and just sit with it. And something really shifted, and I came out, you know, I think it was 6 months later, maybe 9 months, I don't remember. But I came out and felt so light and like happy. And you know, have had turbulence since then, but like really gained a certain amount of self-love in that process that I think shifted things a lot for me. And then my teaching changed again, where I just stopped caring so much, like, about what people thought about it, you know? And up until that point, I'd been really trying to prove something a lot, and I did my first year in the Somatic Movement Educator Program, and did this, like, long road trip across country, and got to teach at different studios and, like, people's houses and an art gallery, and set up a little mini tour for myself, and and camped a lot, and drove by myself, and then in the process met my current partner, and we fell in love, and I had this like amazing romance, and yeah, came back, and just the last 3 years, I guess, have been kind of a continuing not caring, like not caring more and more and more about like what people think of what I do, and it just keeps getting more so. And I feel like I'm more and more interested in what it is that I want to do, and less concerned about whether or not anyone cares, like what people think. And that's been a big thing for me, I think, and it feels like it's I feel like I'm becoming more of an authentic teacher and not trying to teach a certain style. And, you know, some days I'm like honestly interested in moving and sweating and not being like really internally focused, but just motor, you know, movement of energy. And that's what I want to teach. And some days I want to lie on the floor and I want to feel, you know, the movement of my blood through my bone marrow and rest. And then I'll teach that. And I'm learning more and more that it's okay to like rest in a vinyasa class or make people work in a yin class, and that it doesn't, you know, my respect for the names is just a container that actually allows people to contextualize what the class is. And after that, I mean, if people continue to come, then they come for me.
There's something about like, I need to make a living, I need to pay the bills, and there's the temptation is there to look outward and say, oh, well, whoever, Richard Freeman or whoever, has done it this way and that has worked, and so I'll model that. And I think that works, like, on some level for a while. You don't do you or be you, like, you're depriving the world of that magic. Like, sure, some people are going to walk out and be like, Renee's crazy, Kelly's crazy, that wasn't a yin yoga, whatever, you know, like, that's not what I wanted. But, like, that's where you are, like, coalescing with the universe, when you let go of the idea of what has worked or will work for anyone else, and just do what the moment calls for from you.
Yeah, I'm having a little bit of an emotional understanding that's similar to this right now, like, you know, and I think it's all the same thing, right? Just whatever relationships yes. are, whether it's to people or places or a class or something, but something I've been working with presently is not trying to control the emotional response of other people around me, and trusting that they're adult enough to manage their own emotional response, and I don't need to manipulate the situation to get the response that I think that I want, that I can just be clear and put it out there, you know, be kind. Like, I need to manage my own emotional realm, but if I'm clear about something, that I can put it out and I don't need to worry about how it's going to be received. And if it's not received, there is an opportunity for me to look at my own communication, and there's an opportunity for me to be okay with it not being received and just, you know, let it be that. Mm-hmm. And if it is received, then it's, you know, then we go on. But yeah, I think that, like, I don't know, trying to please is so instinctual, you know. I don't know if this is true, but I feel like especially for women, and especially for a certain type of person that might be drawn into, you know, a yoga or mindfulness practice, that we want to be self-reflective and self-aware, and there's a lot of emphasis that's put on, like, conscious communication and right relationship and nonviolence and all this stuff. And, you know, I think that we can get really sucked into a way of living that is seeking a certain type of, non-turbulence.
Yeah, that just then, thinking modulation.
Like. Yeah. That then we kind of, like, get scared of our own waves, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So then how did you make the transition into teaching teachers, like leading yoga teacher trainings?
Well, it's been really recent. And so through Body Mind Centering, I became really interested in anatomy. And through their program, and then also continuing to study with Amy Matthews, who's Bonnie's co-teacher for the EDMY program. And I've continued to study with her independently of BMC, and then to assist her in her program that she does here. And then I, you know, have my own love of anatomy, and, you know, took an A&P course and read my anatomy books and, you know, get it as much as I can just to learn about anatomy and physiology and kinesiology. I love movement and I'm interested in the science of it. And just through that curiosity, I think that's what started, because yoga teacher trainings don't have great anatomy for the most part. You know, Yoga Alliance only requires 20 hours, and anatomy is boring. Like, it's when it's taught just in the from the books or pictures, or when you have to memorize names, it's so boring and it's so hard to learn. And for me, what I love about anatomy is doing experiential anatomy. So, like, feeling a thing. Like, you don't need to know what it's called, but feeling a place, investigating how it moves in someone else, you know, and developing a kinesthetic understanding of something, I think is fascinating. And I think whenever someone is really honestly interested in what it is that they're doing, then that is contagious. So I think I'm a good anatomy teacher because I'm really interested in it, and excited about it, and that's what started. So I started teaching different systems courses apply to yoga, like the skeletal system in yoga, or the organs in yoga, and then got referred for teacher trainings. And I'm a little bit of like a mercenary, like a yoga mercenary, and go and just do anatomy for trainings. And then this past year with Sarah Trelease is the first time I've been a core faculty on a training. And she asked me to come in and teach the anatomy, but then she wanted more than 20 hours. And the more we talked about how the anatomy would be taught, it really came down to teaching experiential anatomy through asana, and then, you know, unfolded into us pretty much sharing the teaching load. Mm-hmm. And redesigning a little bit her model that she had for her program. And it was a really awesome experience for me, and now we are continuing, so we'll do a 500-hour starting in the winter. Yeah, I'm really excited about it, and she, you know, she's kind of bored with, like, mainstream yoga ideas, as am I. So I'm really excited about our program. It's not, I haven't seen anything like it that's available, and we'll focus a lot on contemplative care, which she just finished her Zen chaplaincy program from the New York City Zen Center, and is a chaplain of contemplative care practitioner, works in hospice. So, yeah, and now I teach for 3 different trainings, and I really like it. I can, like, show up as a teacher in the way that I'm really interested in. I get people for a longer amount of time, and I get to focus really specifically on certain things, and I don't feel pressure to give, you know, a 90-minute experience that covers everything everybody wants to do, you know, and I think my weekly classes have gotten better because now I care even less what people think, because I'm not invested in them for my financial stability, which is such a relief. It's such a blessing to not feel like I need to please in order to make money.
Yeah, that's that tension is such an interesting one.
Not every class is a win. Like, I teach so many classes that are probably really boring or frustrating to be in because I'm trying to work something out. Like, I'm using the class for my own learning. And I honestly think that students get a lot out of them. You know, if they're willing to be there with me, they get plenty out of the class that they wouldn't get in a standard class. Mm-hmm. So I attract a different style of students, and I get less the people that want a formula and more the people that are interested in the way that I inquire because it resonates with how they want to inquire. And that totally works for me. I've started to make friends with my students in a way that I didn't before, and I love that. And they feed my questions. But I also think it takes time, you know? Like, I think about Amy, and Amy taught her classes in New York City for years to 2 or 3 people who would show up. And now she's, you know, she's becoming famous and people want to study with her, and she travels around the world. And that, you know, when she was teaching her classes to 2 to 3 people, it wasn't with the intention of someday being famous and traveling around the world. It was because she was genuinely interested and committed to show up if they did.
Absolutely.
And that's, you know, and that's kind of where I feel with it, where I'm like, well, it's actually not my lifelong dream to be, like, a celebrity yoga teacher at all, you know? And I feel like I have a lot of other things that I want to do other than teach yoga classes or to teach anatomy. Like, I have so many other interests, and I'm really interested in this, and if people show up for it, then it's awesome, and I'll keep teaching it.
How does all of this interact with your art?
More and more in a pretty integrated way. I decided to go back to school. So in the fall, I'll begin an MFA program at Portland State that's called Art and Social Practice. And my intention in that program is to develop a curriculum around body awareness and somatic meditation that leads to a creative process of some sort. So whether that's writing or performance or painting or singing, I don't quite know yet. I think I'll explore a lot of different options, but I'm really interested in the body as a transmitter of information, and with storytelling in particular, how, like, energetic and physical resonance can tell a story that words can't tell. In part because I think that, especially with trauma and with sadness, when words evoke sadness, at least for me, like, I have developed the ability to shut down because it's too much. Like, I can't take on the world's sadness. There's, like, so much sadness. And listening to someone's story, there's, like, a I'd say there's, for me, there's less compassion and more pity or like suffering that comes mm-hmm. from feeling separate from that person and somehow like, you know, wanting to make it better for them or wishing there was something I could do. And I feel like when I'm able to somatically resonate with someone, it doesn't matter, like, it doesn't matter that I can't fix their thing, like, whatever it is that their experience is, but I have an understanding of it, and I can recognize their experience as my experience, and then I have a deep investment in whatever the healing of that experience is.
Mm-hmm. It's almost like... Like when you're saying this, like what the like the words that come to me are like embodied empathy. Like,
I think that's good. I mean, I think that there's, there is an embodiment of it that transcends language.
Yeah.
And the you know the language is at this point it doesn't suffice for us anymore. Like we've all heard the stories and we can. For the most part, all say the same things about what we need to do to forgive the past and to move on and to be friends or, you know, to... Mm-hmm. There's so many words. Mm-hmm. And I love words. You know, I love thinking about language, but it's really limiting.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, that, like... I mean, we come up against that or come up to that, like, container, like language's limits... So much, like, in the practice, like, I mean, in the, you know, the Yoga Sutras talk about it too, like, how we're just, and that's part of it, like, holding space for that and it being okay that, like, the words that come out, if they're required, might not have the same meaning mm-hmm. as they do in any other context. Mm-hmm. I like this. I do. I'm excited for you.
Thank you. Mm.
So this is like, how this question has been occurring to me. And I don't want for it to sound rhetorical because it's a real question. It's just something to think about. But like, what do you think the point of yoga is? Like, maybe just for you, or maybe in general, but like, what are we trying to do?
Well, I just finished this book. This is going to be my answer. I just finished this. I study astrology, mm-hmm. and I just finished this book by Dane Rudyer. Called Lunations, the Lunation Cycle, and it's about the phases of the moon, and he talks about the phases of the moon as the relationship of the sun and the moon from the perspective of the earth. Mm-hmm. So rather than, you know, one way of looking at the phases of the moon being like, well, that's just the moon being mysterious and doing her thing, you know, it's okay, that's the moon being the moon and reflecting the light of the sun, who's being the sun, mm-hmm. and the relationship that we all have together, changing our perspective. But the moon isn't really changing, the sun isn't really changing, but our perspective is changing. And so, in the book, and he is a mystic, mm-hmm. And his language is very very mystical. And he writes about this relationship as the sun as being the you know, the source of pure consciousness or Purusha, and the moon as being the manifestation, like all of the organic manifestation of consciousness or Prakriti. He didn't use Purusha and Prakriti. I used those words. And the phases of the moon in that, in the new moon, is when a seed is planted from consciousness into matter. And in the first half of the lunar cycle, moving towards the full moon, is when that seed begins to grow and organic structures are formed, matter comes into being. And at the full moon, whatever it is fully formed, like it arrives and it becomes manifest, it becomes separate from the seer.
Mm-hmm.
And then we can, you know, we have an illumination. We're like, ah, that's the thing. Mm-hmm. And an understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second half of the lunation cycle is the dissemination of whatever that understanding is.
Mm-hmm.
And then the, you know, to further break down the halves into quarters, you might say that at the fourth quarter of the moon, so from the last quarter through the balsamic into the next new moon, is the shedding of old structures and like a disillusionment with whatever it was that has been illuminated, you know, where it's like, oh, well, now I see that that thing is faulted, you know, or doesn't work anymore, or it's time to let it go, and whatever it is. And a new question arises out of need because the last system has left a void.
Mm.
Or the last illumination is left a void. And then whatever that need is the seed that the new moon, that the moon then brings to the sun, and the sun offers up the ray, the answer. And then the cycle continues. So he talks about the moon as bringing the collective wish of mankind for understanding to the source of consciousness, and then consciousness giving it out in small pieces. And, you know, he says, like, humans can't look directly at the sun. We can't perceive the truth of what is, because it would, you know, it would eliminate the need for us to exist.
Mm-hmm.
And Matt, you know, we wouldn't be here. So in order for us to continue in existence, we can look at the moon, and the moon can reflect the light of the sun to us in small doses. And so one piece at a time we can be illuminated and have understandings of whatever it is that consciousness can offer us.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and then he talks about other aspects of the chart or temperament, I guess. But if the seed of the new moon is met within a person or within a culture, if that seed is met with fear or with resistance, then the full moon illumination will be one of opposition and the dualism that creates argument.
Mm.
So I'm me and you're you and we're not agreeing. Or this, you know, this is an oppositional moment and therefore encourages more of a feeling of separateness. And the last half of the lunation cycle and moving towards the balsamic moon will be like a fixation on past values and not a willingness to let go of what needs to be let go of,
mm-hmm.
but like a holding on to structure and how oppositional energy can make us like grasp on to like whatever the ideal is and fight for it.
Yeah.
However, if the new moon seed is greeted with curiosity and with enthusiasm, then the full moon illumination will be the duality that mirrors or reflects the potential of the individual. And he talks about consciousness arising from the individuated self and each individual fully realizing itself to then realize connectivity and relationship. So within the opposition, we can also like see illuminated, like, wow, then there's that potential that exists in me too. Rather than seeing something to fight, we can see a realization. And then the last half of the moon phase will be seeing that potential in everything, disseminating it, and then letting go of anything that doesn't serve the unfolding. I think that's the point of yoga.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's what a practice does. And it it trains us in a certain way to notice when we're greeting things with skepticism or with fear, or gripping when we're not letting go. And it trains us to see the potential in ourselves and to look for truth within duality. You know, Richard talks so much about dualism and non-dualism as really being the same thing, and feeling ourselves, you know, immersed within the place of transition of inhale and exhale and becoming, you know, absorbed within that oneness. And I think that, like, the idea or aspiration for liberation, you know, of the self, like, the to look for liberation from suffering, is the same. It's like that seed of a question that then can be illuminated one layer at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of a practice. And, you know, we have some realization, like, about whatever, like a pose or a way of being, and then it becomes illuminated, and, like, half the time, you know, we grasp onto it and think, like, oh, this is the way, and if I just do it all the time, then, like, things will be good, and
mm-hmm.
then we're forced to let go of it again, and then, you know, and, or we have an illumination about something, and it really transforms our next question.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And over and over
and over and over,
again.
And over, like,
yeah.
Forever.
Yeah.
Like, that's the point.
Mm-hmm. So what's next for you? You're starting school. Does that mean that you're going to be teaching less or teaching more, or?
Yeah, both. I'll teach a few less like weekly drop-in classes, and Sarah and I will have our longer program that we do, and I have a couple of other trainings that I'll teach for throughout the year, and then through my school and inquiry that I have about teaching, I'll hopefully start teaching a yoga and disabilities class. Using a lot of the body mind centering work to work with people who have physical disabilities, and I think more in line with, like, what the energetic function of the asana might be, rather than working with the form of the asana.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a collaboration with a friend, a dancer, and we're teaching BMC and Bhutto.
Mm-hmm.
Bhutto is a contemplative dance, yes. Yeah, so that's coming up, and then hopefully I'll be teaching in the after-school program at King Elementary.
Oh, great.
Doing a body awareness curriculum with kids.
Awesome. Oh. Wow. You're,
yeah.
Like, that's so much.
I know.
That's fantastic.
I know. We'll see. Yeah, but those are all
mm-hmm.
in the works right now.
Mm. And so if listeners want to connect with you, what, or find out what you're working on, what's the best way? Do you have a website? And
yeah, it's just my name, mm-hmm. reneesells.com.
Okay.
And I've been, you know, I need to update the website and include trainings and projects and
mm-hmm.
stuff. It's kind of a constant work in progress.
And you have a lot of wonderful resources available for people on YouTube,
mm-hmm.
and are links to that on your website too? Or
yeah, links to all the videos
okay.
on my website, and then these like the audio meditations,
mm-hmm.
the stories are up on my website.
Oh good. I think the people in our listening sangha will really love that.
Well,
so I'll put links also in the show notes so everyone can find you. And I know in the past you've done a retreat to Costa Rica. Are you doing anything like that again?
Sarah and I will probably do a retreat this autumn somewhere close, in the San Juans or
the San Juans.
In the winter, somewhere in the Pacific Northwest. Next April, I will teach on the faculty for a teacher training in Bali.
Oh, wow. Whereabouts?
I don't know. I'll put a link on my website. I don't really know anything. I mean, I know that the company that I'm teaching the retreat for is called Recharge Retreats. Mm-hmm. And it's owned by a couple who I've never met in person. I've talked to both of them on the phone. They're both coaches and really working on like creative communication and nonviolent communication, and do a lot of work with self-awareness. And they teach that aspect, and then they bring in yoga teachers. Mm-hmm. So Sarah Trelease is also on their faculty, and then they have a wonderful faculty, like a really skilled group of teachers working for them, and I'm really excited to be a part of it. So I'll be with them in April, and then again in November in Thailand. Mm-hmm. And then Costa Rica, I'll do again my own retreat in December of 2015. So not this coming, but the next one.
Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome.
For being here. This was so much fun. I feel like I could do this again with you for,